situation, it would be necessary for us to look to ourselves here. What I mean, would you say from your experience, it is more useful to make a decision day by day, or more useful to make a decision now and try to keep through with it? From your experience, what would you say?
Well, I think I could say that from my experience, I've had I've tried both.
All right, good. All right. And the result?
And I had wonderful results in both, and I had terrible results in both.
All right. Okay. All
right. So I think actually, whenever you, no, I don't feel like it, and still I took the decision yesterday. And I take myself up and then I go out for a walk, down to the beach or whatever. And after an hour or two, I come back and I feel so good.
Yeah.
And it's not just because I did the decision; it was just because it was wonderful.
Yes. Okay.
But some other day, I just feel too lazy, and then I find myself like eating some chocolates and ice creams, and then feeling heavier.
Mm. Or you forget the banana.
Doing whatever things which are sort of from the non-beneficial side.
Are you?
So I can't give you a correct answer.
No.
This way is better or not? That's my question.
With all things where we make decisions and flow along with our decisions, almost for sure there would be periods of interruption in the decision. And therefore, one says, oh, I prefer this kind of food at times, nutritious food or whatever, and almost as sure, at times, it will be interrupted with chocolate. That is called life. The question is, in the interruption, is the result a collapse? A collapse of the benefit of a nutritious diet? Do you start going to that nightmare place, McDonald's, and things in it, junk food, and blah, blah, blah?
No, it's not a collapse. It's just sometimes it runs over itself, and it gets into a. Sometimes it just comes, and then you keep going on this, you know, just a flow, and sometimes it gets closer to self-destruction.
Yeah, all right.
And,
so sometimes there is the interruption, but unfortunately, we identify with it. We perhaps begin to feel a failure or bad about ourselves in some way or other. We can't keep the discipline of the countryside, of the daily meditation, of the eating nutritious food. Then there's a change or a break in that discipline, the effect of which we do something else, whatever it might be, and then we begin to feel bad about ourselves. That produces more conflict, and that makes it even harder to rediscover the discipline. It's not the eating of the chocolate, or you saying, I won't go to the beach, I'll rot in bed or something. You know, or I'm not sitting this day or this week. I don't think that itself, it's how you relate to that time that matters. So when there is an interruption, what's the typical feelings or thoughts or reaction that you have? What would be a typical thing that would go on? You say, I'm just going to eat bananas, and I'm not going to eat Mars bars, and then you find your diet is Mars bars. What would be the reaction?
Once it was, I was really tough with myself. Now I've learned to be softer with that. But,
you sound like I can't think why, but your head keeps reminding me of Buddhist monks. And many Buddhist monks have the same conversation. True, honestly. So Are you trying to be too disciplined, too strict, too hard on yourself, and therefore the reaction or the judgment, and then you say, and then it feels like you're losing it, you're slipping away or something?
I can't really answer that.
No.
Because it would go on and on. There's been a whole process about this since, but actually I'll focus the question just a bit more.
Do you think
there should be like this sort of high determination decision to have a daily sitting, for example?
No, I don't. No.
Could you please say a bit more about that?
Who have you set courses with before?
Oh, who do you think?
Yeah, right. I thought. the one and only Mr. Goenka. Right. Right, it's obvious. Right. So, in some of the traditions, Goenka, famous in the Vipassana world, who is quite strong, isn't he, and encouraging to do a daily sitting, would you say?
Yeah, among other things.
Among other things, but including that. For some, that discipline certainly works very well, and it's a very helpful and useful daily meditation practice. And that form can and does give a lot of support to a lot of people. But for some, it doesn't work easily. And my concern is commitment to wisdom in the whole of the day. That's my concern. And therefore, every act counts equally, every lane, every communication, every task, every job, every commitment to put the priority, our whole heart, mind and body into living wisely every day. And that's the emphasis. If for some people it includes regular sitting and that is helpful, wonderful. If it doesn't, it's okay, because there is still the whole of the day. What's your response? What is your response to the whole of the day?
I can't agree more. I mean, would you?
It would be hard to disagree, wouldn't it, really? Even I say that.
What can I say about that?
So that means with the sitting, formal sitting practice, I do think it is important to have some flexibility. Because some people doing sitting practice, then they lose the energy and the interest for it, and then the person says, oh, my practice is falling apart. I'm not sitting every day. And then the person begins to judge himself or herself. So it's the whole of the day that matters. If regularly you sit regularly, wonderful. That's all. If you eat bananas regularly, wonderful. If you go to the beach regularly, wonderful. Let me ask you now, all of these are practices, of course, they're disciplines, they challenge us. What does all of this lead towards? We don't just meditate just to meditate, we don't just eat bananas to eat bananas, or go to the sea, etc., etc. What's the whole purpose of the path? What's it all lead towards for you? What's your...
For me? It's all part of my inner journey to experience life better and to do it all better for me and for others.
Alright, lovely. Okay. So the intention and the motivation matters, and to experience life better, to experience it more fully. Since you began with the meditations and the practices and the exposure to Dharma, does it feel that the life is more full and rich?
Very much.
Yes? Excellent. Good. All right, enough.
Okay, thank you.
I'd like to relate to two things that you were talking about in two different times yesterday. Two things that Christopher, that you were saying yesterday at two different times, and I'd like to try and make them, see if they can come together, because both of them seem to have a strong appeal to
yes.
me. The one was in the group, you were talking about the ultimate goal as being liberation.
Yeah.
And then when you were asked to clarify it, then you were saying something towards moving from living with, moving to live with your ethics rather than with your ideology.
As one aspect, yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, that was an aspect.
She can't hear, so I'm not used to talking loud. Let's get a bit. All right.
Well, and that was an aspect that was very appealing
yes.
to me, the aspect of moving from living a life of guided by an ideology to living an ethical life.
Yeah.
In the evening talk, you were mentioning, you were talking about the flow of the mind.
Yes.
And not having to the mind not being able to create a reality,
mm-hmm.
therefore kind of let it go. Now there is, if you want to aspire, one wants to get to a life living with his ethics rather than his ideology,
mm-hmm.
then it is something that you want to change, you want to aspire to. And on the other hand, you say don't expect your mind to change the reality.
Oh, I see.
That causes suffering. So there's a...
Oh, I see.
I think it's a contradiction that...
Yeah. If you describe it like that, it is a contradiction. But fair enough. Yes, in the group, in touching on aspects of what freedom is, one feature and an important one of several is looking at the ideology that we find ourselves sometimes very much imprisoned to. And this, of course, can come from the state, from religious authority, educational beliefs, identification with theories, all produces our ideology. And from the ideology comes the values, and the values can be destructive to oneself and to others. And the willingness to look into all of that, I think, is part of our responsibility, in fact, as a human being, to actually question the way that we are tied in with an ideology. In the talk yesterday evening, I can't quite recall saying specifically about not being able to stop suffering. So you have to, and I certainly wouldn't want to leave that impression, so you may have to remind me a little bit more of the content.
Well, no, that might be something that I've added to what you were saying, but you related to the not, you know, suffering from the fact that you cannot change through your mind.
Oh, right, I understand what you mean. Right, I'm with you. I didn't intend to mean it in any absolute sense. So for some people, fresh mental perceptions, fresh intellectual ideas can change our mind from one thing to something else. I mean, the theme of what I was speaking about yesterday evening was sometimes we, as it were, give too much hope and authority to our mind to change our inner life. And so our mind can tell us, change this, change that. Stop being whatever, depressed, angry, upset, in conflict, etc. The mind can keep telling us that, but it may not change anything. And therefore, sometimes we, instead of trying to think things through, we kind of take another road altogether, which we call awareness, or observation, or meditation, and look at things in a different way from just trying to think it through. And that's what I was trying to move towards yesterday evening. So as I mentioned, for some people in the talk, there's a lot going on, a lot of issues going on. And if one can look at the issues at the time, wonderful, or make some time later in the day after the issue has gone quiet for a little reflection, also is important. For other people, nothing much is going on at all, and to be quietly patient with the process of things. And maybe a deeper sense of connection will come, which is one of the strongest ways to challenge ideologies, and the feeling of connection. More important, when you were talking, when you walked up, did you have in yourself any particular ideologies in mind? Did you have any kind of reference point for an ideology?
Well, the reference point is the ideology that that I live by, and that I spend a lot of my time promoting. Yes.
And how would you describe it?
Well, humanistic education.
Yeah. And what would you say are some of the basic principles of humanistic education? What would the thing?
The basic theme, or the center of it, is that the person is the center of and the reason for things, for being, for existence.
So, in a humanistic psychology, there's a core idea that the human being is at the center.
Not in a psychology, in an ideology.
In an ideological sense. What do you perceive as the value, as an ideology, of having the person in the center?
I don't understand the question.
You said to me, it's not in terms of a psychology, it's an ideology.
Yeah, well, because I wasn't talking about humanistic psychology.
No, you're talking about...
There's humanistic psychology, yeah. And I wasn't talking...
No, you're talking about...
I'm talking about humanistic education.
Education, which would be another way of saying secular, is it?
It would be, in many ways, in a lot of what's in it is it's secular.
It's secular.
It's rational.
Yeah, the rational mind. What are your concerns about the ideology?
Oh, I have no concerns about the ideology. I'm very committed and very happy and full with it. But I could relate very well to the difference between living an ethical life and living living an ideological life.
If you take the humanistic or secular educational life, how much differences does it make between peoples, nations? Us and them?
None.
So it doesn't feed the conflict of us and them?
No.
That sounds to me ethical.
Yeah.
So I'm a little curious at the moment as to the original question.
Well,
about ethics and ideology, since it doesn't seem specifically to apply.
No, it doesn't specifically apply. But when we, when talking in general, as the, you were talking about the goal of the practice.
Yeah.
And you were referring to the goal of the practice as something that is creates a change within you.
Yeah, absolutely.
The expectation for that change is in contradiction to what you said yesterday night about letting go and just hoping for things to happen.
No, I didn't mean that. All right. So, in terms of the actual inner process, my concern was yesterday evening to be very watchful of the attachments and the identifications and expectations with the results, with goals. When we as human beings fix our mind so much on goals, it can lead to pressure, intolerance. I want my way no matter what. Reaction towards others, stress, pressure, fear of achieving, all of that kind of the ugly face of the inner life can start developing because of this intensity of I want to achieve this. So the talk this yesterday evening was part of it was focused on please be watchful about this relationship to goals. If we are, there's an ethic already. If we are watchful with our goals, if we have enough humility as human beings to say, this world cannot provide me with everything that I want, there's already ethics, or we're already ethical.
So how does that relate to the ultimate goal?
It relates to the ultimate goal because we begin to see in practical terms how everything is actually related to everything and everyone else. So for any goal to arrive in life, it needs a lot of cooperation. And the self, the ego, the I, me and my, and sometimes in humanism, the feeling I can do it all by myself, and this idea is a hopeless one. And we live in a culture of this individualism, for me and myself, in an intensely secular towards achieving personal goals. And let's see, this ideology really needs examination. If we examine it, it hopefully will awaken us. Is it in the glossary?
No, this is my term.
Oh, sorry.
What I mean to hear from you, because it sounds kind of this is sure this is not the kind, not, this is not the same kind of awakening that Buddha had. This is for sure. But it seems like there is a state of awakening of the Western people like us. Mm. Then we are striving to go through calmness.
Ah, I see. Yeah.
In order to achieve, or maybe not achieve, but maybe. Yeah. And this, there is also a question whether Westerns did, were they more Buddhas after this Buddha?
Yeah, pardon? Yeah,
the Western Buddhas. Since then?
Yeah, before and after. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And how does this process go?
Short or long term?
In the term of a lifetime.
Oh, lifetime. All right. I'll quote the Buddha for a moment. All right? Since we referred to him. the Buddha says, in this world, there are four kinds of people. The first kind of person is a person who is neither practicing nor, he says, instructed in the teachings and practices to wake up. So this person, everything that happens to them is real. Every mind state, everything that goes on in their life there. And that such a person lives in that world. Understand? So there's no interest in, say, in anything like this. The person lives in the world of mind, body, time, self and other, living, dying and death, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
No questioning.
Yeah, no questioning.
Right. This is one kind of person in this world. Many. There are, the second kind of person in this world is a person who is questioning, who is inquiring, who is looking into things, and therefore exposed to teachings and practices in various ways. The third kind of person has realized the fruits of these practices, and in that knows their liberation and also knows the profound interconnectedness of all things. Third kind. Fourth kind of person is one who knows and teaches. One who knows and teaches is called a Buddha. That is the name. It got across it now. Huge, big capital B, but it is terribly unfortunate.
Excuse me. That means that you are a Buddha.
do you know the Buddhist world? If I said yes.
Ah.
So, the I making claims. If I said, you know, anybody says, there are a few around. It says, I said, I am a Buddha.
Ooh. That's too big to say. Too
big. In the Buddhist world, it's mega big.
I have a question between the third group and the third kind of person.
No,
the second and the third.
Second and the third.
Second and the third.
Yeah.
You said... the second group are the one who are practicing, searching, but not exactly knowing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
So if we would like to enter the third group, I mean...
Then the knowing is essential knowing is the knowing of genuine freedom here and now, this again deep sense of connectedness with all things, a real noticeable absence of suffering or problems in life. One has woke up. This means the awakened. One has woke up. And the analogy which is used is a powerful one. When we are in the night having a dream, and it's a very strong dream, what's going on with us and in our dream in the middle of the night genuinely seems incredibly real. You know, we've been chased by a tiger,
yes,
or sitting on the top of the mountain giving a sermon or something. It seems very, very real in the dream. Then there's a change and we wake up and we say, my goodness, it was a dream. At the time it seemed so real, but it was a dream, and now I'm out of this dream. That's that quality of waking up. So when in daily life we are lost in problems, fears, worries, anguishes, negativity, selfishness, conceit, etc., in these teachings, that's living in a dream.
Yes.
Painful. It seems very real, but it's a dream world. Waking up out of that is the third person, has woken up out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And even sometimes when there's a problem in our life, you know, and it's not clear, not resolved, sometimes in the very middle of it, we know it. What is it? few feelings and thoughts, pictures and images arising, and sometimes there's an intuition inside. We know it's not the drama we or others are making it to be. It's already the whisper of the third kind of person. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we don't. We really believe in the drama. We're completely lost in it, totally involved in it. And then we're, as it were, the second kind of person if we're trying to find a way through it. So are you, where are you? One, two, or three? Four. It's wonderful.
Maybe human being, beings like drama. And you said the awakening is without drama at all.
The awakening, some beings, I agree, some beings are very attracted to drama. But some of us are more attracted to Dharma than drama. And when there is less, as it were, drama in our inner life, we are much more able to deal with the dramas in others' lives. When we are lost in our own personal drama, very hard to to be. So we don't have to be worried that, my goodness, if I become the third kind of person, there'll be no more drama in life. There'll be more.
Because, we don't have to worry about it.
Because people will be coming to talk about their drama.
Okay.
So how much time and exposure have you had as the second kind of person on this world?
How much time?
Meditation.
I'm doing it the second year only. The second year.
Pardon?
I'm practicing only 1 year.
Oh, I see. So
I'm now in the second year, so I'm
and
quite recent.
When you walked up, is that word cult on your T-shirt?
Ah, cult?
Is it cult? C-U-L-T?
I don't know. A C.
It says cult, ready for action.
What does it mean?
Exactly. I was a little concerned.
I was meditating, not looking. I didn't notice that.
No. So, keeping the interest and the questioning and the exploration and the meditations alive, and so through that inner change can come. We bring in, as it were, more of the dharma of life, taking out more of the personal drama of life, and that genuinely deepens our love and warmth and affection for others and deep concern for them as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.